Good day, and welcome to the Anacap Financial Europe conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Chris Ross-Roberts. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Sandy. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Anacap Financial Europe SACCAF RAIF investor presentation for the year ending the 31st of December 2018. As set out on page two of the presentation, Justin, Ed and I will take you through the presentation, and then we'll open the line to a Q&A session at the end. In addition to the Q&A session, please remember you can send any questions through to info@anacapfe.com or through the website at www.anacapfe.com, where we'll endeavour to reply to them as soon as possible. Details of this can be found at the end of the presentation. Before I begin, can I please draw your attention to the disclaimer on page one of the presentation, which highlights that the presentation is produced solely for informational purposes and cautions against any forward-looking statements, and that by attending this call and reviewing the presentation, you're agreeing to the limitations set out on page one of the presentation. I'd like to start by turning to page three, basis of preparation of the financial statements, before handing over to Justin. The results for AFE we are presenting today cover the period the 31st of December 2018, and as the acquisition of the portfolio business was completed on the 21st of July 2017, there are comparatives included in the financial statements for the previous year, but these are only to reflect the results of the company since the date of acquisition of the portfolio business. Therefore, in order to provide bondholders and other interested parties the comparative data for the 12 months 31st of December 2018, this presentation includes the results of the portfolio business to the date of the acquisition, combined with the results of AFE for the balance of 2017. I'll now hand over to Justin, who will start by covering the highlights and capital deployed. Justin.
Thanks, Chris. AFE completed $28.9 million of new portfolio purchases in the fourth quarter, which resulted in deployment for all of 2018 at 161.5 million euros compared to 65 million euros in 2017, which embeds significant growth in cash generation out to 2020. As we have demonstrated previously, and Chris will address in more detail later, the cash flow profile of ACE predominantly secured debt is such that we expect to see growth in collections even when we may slow down deployment. This includes completion of ACE's first transaction in Poland, continuing the strategy of selective deployment in predominantly secured debt and incremental geographic diversification. We've discussed Poland previously, as it's a market where Anacap has significant prior experience, including ownership of a bank locally in our private equity funds. But now we are continuing to see significant development in the secured portfolio market specifically. Strong Q4 collections bring the full year to 133.7 million euros, which is in line with forecast and 8.7% greater than the year ending 31st December 2017. Despite some degree of volatility in timing quarter on quarter, given the secured nature of assets, our overall forecasting remains accurate. The last 12 months adjusted EBITDA of 97 million euros is up 7.6% compared to the last 12 months of 90.2 million at the end of December 17. This is reflecting strong cash generation from both our increasingly seasoned back book as well as new purchases. Leverage metrics of net debt to last 12 month adjusted EBITDA at 3.74 times and the LTV ratio of 62.1% are both significantly down on September's quarter-end numbers and considerably down since inception. But as discussed previously, we do expect leverage to rise temporarily after periods of increased deployment. Our market-leading cost structure with total operating costs, including overheads, of just over 24% of gross collections is a significant driver of continued profitable growth. While we've continued to invest in our operational infrastructure, we certainly think this remains a key competitive advantage. Turning to the next slide, I wanted to discuss deployment and the profile of our deployment over time. You can see that we continue to diversify ERC across primarily our core geographies, where today Italy represents 42% of total 84-month ERC, which is down from 64% at the end of 2017, with Portugal and Spain at 23% and 21% respectively. Overall, we expect to remain very selective in deployment, particularly following a recent period of growth, with our focus remaining on predominantly small balance secured debt in our core geographies. Now I'll turn it back over to Chris for more detail on the financials.
Thanks, Justin. If you can turn to page 9, key financial highlights for the year ended 31st December 2018, strong growth in deployment, core collections, and adjusted EBITDA in 2018. As you heard from Justin, we successfully deployed 161.5 million of capital in 2018, taking the average over the last 2 years to 113.3 million. We would anticipate to deploy capital at similar or marginally higher rates next year or this current year, but we'll continue to remain selective in where and how we choose to deploy. As anticipated, revenue in the 12 months to the 31st of December 2018 has dropped by 4.2% to 75.6 million compared to the same period in the prior year, as ERC at the start of the period was 437.9 compared to 508 in March 17. A weighted average basis for deployment for the year took place at 7.3 months, i.e. August, so the benefit of recent deployment will feed through into revenue in the coming months and will grow in 2019 as the full-year impact is recognised. Core collections have grown by 8.7% to 133.7 million for the 12 months to the 31st December 2018, with a successful Q4 ahead of our June forecast. The total operating cost ratio marginally decreased in the period from 24.6% for the 12 months to 31 December 17 to 24.3% in the 12 months, 31 December 18, reflecting some modest investment in the asset management platform in Spain and Portugal, offset by a lower collection cost on some of our larger positions realised during the period. It's worth noting that the operating cost ratio we refer to is the total operating cost ratio, excluding non-recurring items, rather than a cost-to-collect ratio, and therefore includes all overheads of the business. Our overhead structure is predominantly variable, relative to the value of what her portfolio is held in the business. A relatively low overhead, driven by the use of our digital platform Minerva and its variable nature, results in an overall higher margin. In summary, AFP's total operating costs remain market leading. However, we should point out, as I did last quarter, that the overall operating cost ratio is driven by strong collections in the 12 months to date, includes the realisation of a few large positions that have a relatively low cost to collect as a percentage of collections. It also reflects the maturity of the book acquired by AFE, where cost has been invested in expense in advance of receiving collections. The operating cost ratio can be impacted in the short term by significant deployment and front-loading of costs, stamp duty, court costs, transfer tax, etc., which are, if relevant, expensed as incurred. I would anticipate a short-term increase in 2019. Adjusted EBITDA has increased to 97 million, up 51% from March 17 at the time of the bond issuance, and an 8.7% increase on 2017. Later in the presentation, I'll cover the impact on adjusted EBITDA on recent purchases and how this grows over time. Normalised EBITDA margin remains very high, at 72.6%. We can turn to page 10, growth in collections in ERC. We can see a graphic representation of the growth in gross collections since 2014 to 2018. From that period, the CAGR on core collections, which excludes sales of previously owned Spanish and Portuguese portfolios, is a growth of 24%. In the current year, collections have grown by 8.7%. As I'll come on to the show further, growth in collections lag deployment, particularly given the nature of secured portfolios we've recently invested in. We would anticipate collections to grow more rapidly in 2020. ERC has grown during the period to $585.1 million, following the significant deployment in 2018, and now it's 33.6% higher than the start of the year. The increase in deployment will drive growth in revenue and collections, but given the secured nature of the recent deployment, the growth in collections will lag revenue. We can turn to page 11. Incremental volatility in attributable collections driven by small timing differences. Given the nature of our secure portfolio with some larger average balances, we always anticipate some volatility over the timing of the sale of collateral assets. Ed will give you some colour on the underlying collateral and balance distribution later on in the presentation. As a reminder, each half year we undertake a full line-by-line review of the portfolio with our services and asset managers to assess both the value of the underlying collateral and update estimates of timing, collections and costs. We reflect any changes in collections estimates within our ERC at that time, which we also review analytically at the end of each quarter and adjust if necessary. You'll note from the graphs on page 11 that we exceeded our forecast made in December 17 in H1 by 11%, but missed the forecast by 10% in the second half. However, as part of our normal review of ERC, we had adjusted our forecast at the end of June and booked any resulting impairment in H1. We, however, exceeded our June forecast by 3% and achieved 98% of our original forecast. The delta in forecast is predominantly around timing of receipts, which can be difficult to predict within a short time frame. For example, there may be times when asset sales are delayed will take longer to realise as we seek to maximise overall returns on an NPV basis. Or conversely, as litigation progresses, an individual offer may be made. As Ed will come on to show, given the nature of our secure portfolio and recent purchase of more secure portfolios, our ERC is underpinned by significant collateral. Turning to page 12. Recent deployment embeds growth in cash generation in 2020, a good indicator of adjusted EBITDA growth. The graph on page 12 splits out ERC by year and geography. 2018 attributable collections, the difference between actual attributable collections and core stroke gross collections, is collections made on behalf of investors, is shown for reference. You'll note from the profile that given recent purchases and expected time of collections, that the business has embedded growth in cash flow from its current back book out to 2020, a key lead indicator of adjusted EBITDA growth without any further deployment. Given our predominantly variable cost structure and the fact that costs tend to be incurred in front of collections, this graph should be a useful guide in estimating the pattern or adjusted EBITDA from currently owned assets. In addition, given we have recently deployed capital across four geographies, including Poland, collections by country are more diversified and more reflective of the countries that the ANACAP platform has been operating in for many years. Portugal and Spain now accounting for 44% of ERC and Italy 42%. Turning to page 13, recent deployment may also temporarily increase costs prior to a growth in adjusted EBITDA. On this page, I've set out the forward-looking collections, collection activity costs, and the resulting EBITDA for the 2018 vintage of deployment from the resulting ERC that we have at the end of December 2018 for the next 3 years. You'll note from the bar charts on the left of the page that we expect gross collections from 2018 purchases to be $36 million in 2019, rising to $69.7 million in 2020, before going to $65.1 million in 2021. The percentage shown on the table are the percentage of future collections in any one year of the 2018 vintage ERC as at 31 December 2018, so ignores collections already made for 2018 purchases. I.e., we expect to collect 16% of 2018 vintage December ERC in 2019 and 31% in 2020, almost a doubling of collections. On the right-hand side, we set out the expected costs for the 2018 vintage that we forecast to incur. You'll note that 2019 is higher than subsequent years, and this is due to front-loading of costs, including where relevant, stamp duty, transfer tax, court costs, legal fees, etc., which are paid in advance and or during a judicial process, or if we repossess the collateral. This cost can vary if we reach an amicable settlement with the debtor, in which case they would be significantly less. The resultant impact on adjusted EBITDA is shown at the bottom table, where you can see a significant increase in the impact for the 20,018 deployment in 2020, adjusted EBITDA. This is a similar message to that shown on the overall pattern of ERC set out on the previous page, and why we are so confident of growth in adjusted EBITDA from existing assets out to 2020. I would expect our cost to collect ratio to increase during 2019. Just as a reminder, our collection cost activities includes all the SPV operating costs, as well as collection costs and all legal fees, etc. So turning to page 14, leading cost structures and margins, operating expenses have declined from 35% of collections to 24% of collections from 14 to 2018, reflecting apart from recent 2018 deployment, the relative maturity of the back book. Overheads have increased marginally, reflecting the increase in asset management and master servicing capabilities in Spain and Portugal in advance of significant expected collections from recently acquired portfolios. Normalised adjusted EBITDA grew to $97 million over the period, and as we discussed earlier, we expect recent deployment to have a larger impact in 2020 than in 2019. Turning to page 15. High margin operating platform. Whilst the overall size of our balance sheet may be relatively modest compared to the larger debt purchasers, our investment into predominantly secured assets with the underpin of significant collateral, embedded growth in cash flows, together with a market-leading low overall cost structure, results in high levels of operating profit relative to size. In the current year, we've achieved an operating profit of 53% and a profit after tax of 27%. In conclusion, total operating costs of the business are market leading, predominantly variable in line with activity and assets under management. To date, they reflect the maturity of the back book acquired as the initial portfolio. And as discussed in the earlier slides, when a portfolio is acquired, the costs in the earlier first full year or 18 months tend to be higher as the cost of onboarding the portfolio and any initial upfront costs are incurred. We can turn to page 16, positive key debt metrics. As you've heard, ERC has grown to $585 million, up from $437 million. And you will note that recent purchases have had a positive impact on the LTV ratio, which now stands at 62.1%, against a 75% threshold, giving significant headroom, and 63.5% as at the December 17. Super senior revolving credit facility covenant stands at 3.3% against the threshold of 25%, again giving us significant headroom. Fixed cover charge ratio stands at 4.73 times. We entered Q1 with over $60 million of liquidity in a quarter which we anticipate to have little deployments. The net debt to LTM adjusted EBITDA stands at 3.74, below the guidance we gave last quarter of 4 and a bit, notwithstanding significant deployment in advance of our embedded growth in adjusted EBITDA. Turn to page 17. proven ability to delever, leverage in line with market guidance. You'll note from the graph at the top of the page that since March 2017, group leverage fell from 4.6 times to 2.68 times in a single year. During that period, we deployed a relatively modest amount of capital of $25.4 million. Following recent deployment, 2018 leverage has increased to 3.74 times. This is, of course, a static snapshot at a point in time and reflects the fact that the debt has been incurred at the quarter ends, and given the collections profile of the secured book purchase, collections will follow in future years, and therefore adjusted EBITDA will lag deployment by some time, as reflected in our ERC profile, he set out on page 12. If we calculate a simple pro forma leverage ratio by applying the current margin based on the current operating cost to the current 2020 ERC, that suggests an adjusted EBITDA of $121.9 million in 2020, circa a 25% increase for any further deployment. That gives a pro forma leverage of 3 times as at 31 December 2018. I'll provide more details later in the presentation on this calculation. This is further supported by the graph below that demonstrates the effective lag between deployment in 2016 and growth in adjusted EBITDA, with a modest drop following a slowdown of deployment in 2017. We'd anticipate a similar shape going forward. Turning to page 18, financial policy, we have set out on page 18 FE's financial policy, given our continued focus on predominantly secure portfolios where collections are generally higher in years 2 and 3 following the year of purchase. Costs are generally lower as a percentage of collections, as we discussed earlier. Our policy adopts a pro forma net debt to EBITDA ratio that takes into account the anticipated collections from assets owned by the business and the resulting anticipated adjusted EBITDA against debt at the end of the period. Otherwise, the balance sheet reflects debt at a static point in time with a backward-looking profit profile that excludes the benefit of assets recently purchased. We've set a policy with a maximum pro forma leverage ratio of 3.5 times. As of the 31st of December, the pro forma leverage was 3 times. The calculation of this is set out on slide 18 as follows. First of all, we take our forecast collections for the existing assets in 2020, as set out on page 12, at $161 million. We then apply our all-in collection cost ratio, which excludes overheads, to determine pro forma adjusted EBITDA, and that comes out at 121.9. Given net debt at 31 December is 363, that gives a pro forma leverage of 3 times. And given the typical collection profile and cost profile set out on page 13, we can expect adjusted EBITDA to vary in the short term. In respect to dividends, we have proposed a dividend of $10.1 million payable in March 2019. No further dividends are expected to be paid in 2019. The dividends are expected to be paid annually. However, this is clearly subject to leverage, liquidity, and overall profitability. In respect of our capital structure, we are constantly reviewing our capital structure and liquidity position and will look to optimise this over time. Depending on market conditions and our operating results, this could include open market repurchases of securities, amongst other strategies. I'll now hand over to Ed to give you some more insight into AFE's ERC and asset management.
Thank you, Chris. I will touch on the evolution of the composition of our portfolio ERC, the underlying collateralization of that ERC, and the continued development of our Minerva digital platform and wider operational capability to optimize performance. So starting first with ERC composition on slide 20, the targeted deployment activity through 2018 has resulted in enhanced geographic diversification. Italy has moved from 64% to 42% of 84-month ERC, Spain from 14 to 23%, Portugal from 15 to 21%, and Poland now represents 7% of our ERC. From an asset type perspective, targeted deployment has driven an increase in secured asset types over the course of the year, especially in secured consumer NPLs, which have increased from 6 to 24%. Turning over to slide 21 and the analysis of gross money multiples by vintage, you'll see that our deployment activity within the past 24 months has focused almost exclusively on secured NPLs, 97% in 2017 and 99% in 2018. In the context of market-wide declining trends in gross money multiples, we have targeted secured NPLs as the most attractive asset class on a risk-return basis, driven by strong underlying collateralization, efficient cost to collect, and the relative quick payback, as evidenced by the gross collections to date for recent vintages. And Chris has already walked you through the relative quick payback that is expected over the next 2 to 3 years on the 2018 vintage. Turning to slide 22 and stepping back and now looking at our overall portfolio in aggregate, you'll see a breakdown of our portfolio by balance bands. The blue bars chart the distribution of account volume, i.e. numbers of accounts. The beige bars chart the distribution of account value, i.e. account balances. With approximately 40% of our ERC within mixed and unsecured portfolios, the majority of account volume is located within smaller sub-10K balance bands. However, the majority of our account value sits within higher balance bandings, reflecting the significantly secured nature of the book. In these larger balance bandings, our approach to underwriting, valuation, and ongoing forecasting is driven by an in-depth review of the underlying collateral, leveraging our own in-house data, supplemented by external real estate valuations, in conjunction with a forensic assessment of the legal status and trajectory. And looking at how this view of collateral compares to our overall ERC expectations, you'll see on slide 23 a breakdown of our 84-month ERC into its underlying security type. Of our current 585.1 million of ERC, 444.8 is constituted by secured positions, underwritten with reference to underlying collateral value. 23.6 million is sale proceeds from underlying assets, currently in the court distribution process. The residual 116.7 million is unsecured. So in summary, as of today, 79% of our ERC is secured by hard assets, an increase from 68% as per this time last year, reflecting the focus on secured assets over the last 12 months. This secured ERC is backed by significant collateralization. The underlying assets that back our 444.8 ERC have a market value of 777 million. The differential between these two values is the headroom that we incorporate into our underwriting and ongoing forecasting. It gives us flexibility and agility in terms of our selection of our overall resolution path and timetable. We are continuing to enhance our operational platform to maximize recoveries across all segments. Turning to slide 24, our servicer panel has increased from 13 to 14 with the addition of a new servicing partner in Poland. We are also continuing to develop our digital platform Minerva to meet the demands of our portfolio. Combining the ability to run statistically driven campaigns on our unsecured books with the ability to track individual borrower level information to enable us to monitor large positions on a systematic basis. In addition to digital development, we are taking further steps to develop our local infrastructure with 19 new hires within local subsidiaries in Spain and Italy, focusing on real estate, legal recoveries, and analytics. The combination of enhanced digital capabilities and localized technical expertise will continue to support improvements in our asset realization performance. I'll now hand over to Justin for concluding remarks.
Thanks, Ed. Turning to slide 26. So we've completed $161.5 million of deployment over the past year, which has led to greater ERC diversification across our core geographies and embedded future growth in annual gross collections out to 2020. The completion of our first portfolio acquisition in Poland, as secured debt opportunities continue to develop locally, leverages Anacap's wider investment track record and deeper knowledge and deep knowledge of the local market. Our deployment will remain selective, with a primary focus on secured consumer and SME debt underpinned by significant collateralization, where Anacap has extensive local experience. If you look at our run rate of deployment over the past 2 years, you'll see that that averages out between 100 and 125 million euros, and we think this is comfortably in a zone where we can remain focused on the best risk-adjusted returns. The strong financial performance, with core collections continuing to grow in line with forecasts from a seasoned back book, even as new capital deployment remains highly selective. This is reflected in a 33.6% growth in ERC year-on-year, from 437.9 million at the end of 2017 to 585 million at the end of 2018. 8.7% growth in core collections year-on-year, from 123 to 133.7 million euros. And again, the leverage at the end of 2018 is down from the end of September to 3.74 times. This reflects a proven ability to delever rapidly due to embedded growth in cash flow from the seasoning back book and new predominantly secured portfolio purchases. And finally, the continued development of the AIFE operating platform, we're enhancing local operations and our analytics function, along with our Minerva IT platform, is continuing to support a market-leading cost structure and significant continued profitability. I think at this point, we'd like to turn it over to questions.
If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. We pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. The first question comes from Frank Lehmann at Zero Capital. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi, gentlemen. Thank you very much for walking me through the presentation, and congratulations. Appears you had a real successful 2018. From a more strategic point of view, as a bondholder, I'm rather frustrated seeing the bond trade at 78.80, anywhere around there. You did mention that you might potentially be looking into buying back bonds, putting some capital into the bonds. What's going on there, and why is your bond not reflecting the successful operations which you present on a quarterly basis and today on an annual basis, and where I have very little questions about? Thank you.
Hi, it's Chris. Look, I think we feel as a team we've had a successful our first full year of operation under the AIFE umbrella. We purchased well, we've diversified our asset base, our levels of profitability are very high, our leverage is relatively modest given the secured nature of the back book. So we feel very positive about both the historic performance that we've had and the more long-term outlook to 2020. Clearly, I've given you the profile for 19. Why the bond is trading where it is, I don't know that answer. It doesn't seem to make sense to us. There are some issues with technicals in terms of its size, and we're relatively small. And in terms of our capital structure liquidity, I can't really say much more than I've already said, but we keep that under constant review. We will look to optimize it. And depending on the market conditions and our results, we may adopt a number of different strategies, but we are keeping a very close eye on that.
If you allow me to follow up on the question, could it be that you just might have to do a little roadshow and meet some significant investors who might have overlooked the position your bond is in, and the underlying structure has not really been analyzed because it's below 500 million. A bit of roadshowing the company, and I guess that might bring the bond prices to where it, from my point of view, feels it should be. Because when we look at the markets, we always recognize there's kind of a huge bid offer. There's an overhang in people who want to sell, and even deals are printed away from what we see on the screens, which is actually a bit worrisome. All right, I leave it here. Thank you very much for the answer.
I'd say, just to follow up on that, this is Justin. We appreciate your comments, and we absolutely agree that increased communication is a good thing. We have participated in some of that recently, and we do expect to participate in further conferences, I think next at Morgan Stanley's conference in the first week of April. So certainly we will look to that and other potential forums to continue to communicate, because we absolutely agree that we think there's some things, perhaps because it is a small issuance by nature, some of the things like the growth and profitability and the proven ability to delever, doesn't seem the market's given much consideration for that during that period, and perhaps, you know, the price in our bond is perhaps not reflected, you know, the actual financial performance. So we certainly welcome the opportunity to speak more to investors, and thanks for pointing that out. We will, you know, continue to look to do so.
Thank you very much.
If you find that your question has been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing star 2. The next question comes from Vera Shah at Credit Suisse.
Hi, team. This is Viral Shah from Credit Suisse Asset Management. Again, thanks for the presentation. A couple of questions, both on the topic of dividends, but I think it's best if I take them one after the other. You know, taking a step back, you kind of alluded to the bond trading levels and how that's an externality. But you know, just thinking about what's happened since the transaction. The equity infusion at the time of the transaction was about $1.3 million. You know, the bonds are down 25%. Leverage is broadly flat since March 2017. I know in your page 17 of the presentations, you're showing a bit of a deleveraging profile, but if I go back to the original transaction, you know, leverage is pretty much flat. Liquidity is also broadly flat. You know, clearly the sector has seen some challenges in multiples on new purchases. You know, in light of this environment, how are you kind of thinking about the dividend payout? And that's a bit surprising. So, you know, thought would open it up to questions on your rationale and thinking behind the dividend. Post that, I can give a second question.
Yeah, it's Chris. Let me just answer a couple of bits of those questions, and then I'll get Justin to skip it. In respect to the bond, so within my presentation, I gave you the 4.6 is the actual net debt to adjusted EBITDA. At the time we did the roadshow, we presented a pro forma debt metric similar to the one we presented as part of our financial policy. So leverage has come down, and obviously it decreased very significantly down to 2.68 in terms of March. So I just wanted to just pick you up on that point. Justin, do you want to have a dividend?
Yes, I think in terms of the dividend, I mean, obviously it's the only dividend we've paid in almost 2 years. We certainly think in the context of what remains a very profitable business, that this is something we may look to do. Obviously, as we've said earlier, we continually look and monitor ways we can use our excess liquidity, not only in terms of dividends, but obviously purchases and other considerations vis-a-vis our capital structure, and we will continue to do so across the board.
Thanks. Just on the point, Chris, on your point on, you know, pro forma EBITDA, I think the 80 million showed there, the 20 million of that was just attributable collections, right? It wasn't any adjustments. It wasn't any forward looking. It was just a timing, thing from the vehicle, and it was attributable collections, right?
No. The method of calculating the pro forma leverage was, in the OM, was to say as if we'd owned all of these assets from the start of the year rather than the date we actually purchased them, what would
exactly.
The cash flows be? So it wasn't a spot leverage. So the spot leverage at the time was 4.6. So if you're comparing 4.6 to 3.74, those two numbers are consistently prepared. You're slightly refined the way you're looking at it in terms of leverage. So if, when I, you know, hopefully I've given you enough data to look at what 2020 looks like, and I'd encourage everyone to look to 2020. And if you assume some modest deployment around the sort of average levels that we've done over the last 2 years, you'll see that actually there's a very significant jump in adjusted EBITDA, and we can see that from our collections profile. There's also likely, as I said, because I gave you the cost profile on the 18 vintage, you know, some costs will be incurred up front, particularly if we choose to repossess a number of properties and pay the taxes. So I don't expect any growth in EBITDA in 2019, but, you know, the level of increase in 2020 is very, very significant, all things being equal. And hopefully the presentation gives you enough math to look at that. And when I look at that level of profitability in the context of a pretty modest dividend, I feel very comfortable about the outlook for the business.
Thanks. You know, just the second part of my question quickly. I think the presentation also mentions that the dividends are subject to leverage liquidity levels. Please, can you elaborate on, you know, what the thresholds, what the red lines are for these levels? So essentially, is there a leverage metric where you'll only pay future dividends if you hit that leverage number? Or, you know, what are kind of these leverage and liquidity levels that are mentioned in the presentation?
Well, look, I think we've set out what our financial policy is. So we take, you know, looking forward, I think if you just take a static snapshot and you buy something at the end of the year and you've got no adjusted EBITDA for that asset, it's wrong to calculate asset on a backward-looking level, particularly given the secure nature of our book. We set what that maximum policy is at 3.5 times. In all the scenarios that I look at and I run a large number of different scenarios, with different volumes of purchases and collection achievements, then we feel very comfortable that leverage will decline significantly 2020 outwards. You know, if there was some reason where we felt, that it was close to that policy or had an adverse impact on that forward-looking policy, then we'd clearly reconsider the quantum of the dividend.
I think this is Justin. I think part of that obviously goes back to the earlier point and the earlier question around increased investor awareness. We certainly were trying to do that here, but we will look to do it more to really explain maybe some of the positive differentiation we see in terms of the cash flow profile of our assets, which, you know, it has been reflected in a proven ability to delever in the past, and we'll expect it to do so in the future. But certainly I think this is an important point, that given the nature where we are quite pleased with our results and when we're quite happy where we believe we're achieving better risk-adjusted returns, we obviously want to make sure that's reflected in the understanding of the business and the expected cash flow profile as well.
And also from a credit point of view, the fact that our cost structure is pretty variable and we're not overburdened with huge overheads and thousands of staff, we have the ability, like we did in 2017, to take a pause for a relatively short period that had a massive impact on the deleveraging of our business.
Thanks. Last question on this topic, and then we can move on. But I think you'll appreciate the problem with tying the dividend policy to a forward-looking leverage guidance is that, if for some reason, for example, last year you had an issue on one of the portfolios, there was an impairment, but the dividend has already been paid out based on the forward-looking guidance. So would you be looking to do a clawback adjustment mechanism on your dividend payouts?
Well, look, if there's any, you ask what the hard lines are, if there's an impairment, that impacts profit. Profit is obviously what's used under the bond documentation in calculating the allowable distribution. Profit also impacts retained earnings, which again is another hard line, which we can't end up with negative retained earnings. So if there was any hit to an impairment or any other unforeseen event that impacted, say, 90, you know, impacted a year, then that basket has to be refilled as a matter of math before a dividend can be paid.
Sure, thanks. That's it from me.
Thank you.
The next question comes from Alex Fife at Apollo.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Justin. Thanks for the presentation. Two questions from my side. The first one is, if I look at your cash flow statements, it looks like the majority of the portfolio purchases in Q3 and 4 are getting marked as investment in JVs. You know, presumably because you don't hold a majority stake in those portfolios. Just wondering if you can provide some color on kind of why they get classified as that, you know, who the co-investors are, if there are any, and whether those co-investors own the majority of the portfolios, and then whether there's any kind of portfolio-level debt that sits in those JVs.
Okay. Let me answer the last question first. There's no portfolio-level debt in those JVs. In respect of one of the JVs, we actually are the majority investor. There is a third-party co-investor. But given the nature of that investment, effectively it's treated as a joint venture because both parties have to agree to an asset disposal, for example. So it's considered that we don't have control, you know, individual majority control on asset-level decisions. So it's quite a sort of technical way of accounting for it as a joint venture. But all the economics are the same as if we owned the same proportionate share of a loan note or the other one. The other one is held in the other joint venture is an asset that's held in one of our Italian vehicles that's under ACE structure, and where we are an equal co-investor with another party. Those are held through loan notes, so we account for our share of cash and only our share of ERC in the balance sheet. But it's a similar joint decision-making process in terms of asset sales or approving changes to a business plan that a servicer might undertake.
Okay. Second question was, on the new term loan facility you guys agreed in Q4, could you just give us some more color on what that is? I mean, is it parity to the bonds, or is it structured senior? You know, does it guarantee specific assets? Does it amortize? Stuff like that.
So it's a non-recourse facility with security over the assets in that vehicle that is outside the restricted group. It's effectively a bit like a securitization, although it's not a securitization, in that there is most of the proceeds go directly to the lender after permitted leakage for costs and expenses. But then over time, our leakage increases to 50%. And then obviously 100%.
Got you. And so when in the statements, when I think you guys talk about like a leverage covenant, but it's expressed as a percentage, presumably that's LTV over book value of that portfolio?
Yes. It's calculated differently under slightly different circumstances. So if we're looking at a super senior calculation, it's slightly different to the bond calculation. So anything that is in that vehicle is within a permitted basket under the bond documentation and is calculated accordingly. The super senior covenant has a slightly different covenant calculation on.
Okay. And then I guess, you know, you're talking about ERC going out, or ERC being bigger in 2020. Is that because the cash flows on that portfolio in 2019 actually go to that? No, that wouldn't make sense. I was going to say go to the term loan, but then actually no, because that would be on balance sheet. Yeah. Okay.
That was just,
sorry, go ahead.
So I was just saying, that was a look at the entire 2018 vintage specifically, the entire 2018 vintage. So not overall ERC, but to reflect the fact that new purchases have embedded growth in cash flow. And that I think one of the things that we've tried to show here is, as the business has done in the past, is the business does have the ability to naturally delever as growth in collections from the back book comes through as well. That's not totally ERC. That's just a reflection of growth on the vintage that we recently purchased.
Got you. And then I guess just on that topic, I mean, I was a bit surprised to see the multiple still being 1.6, given you expect, like, the collections in this vintage to happen kind of in 2020. So I guess my question is, like, are you still underwriting the same IRRs, or does this portfolio have a kind of lower unlevered IRR than what you've underwritten in the past?
No, we think IRRs are similar to incrementally higher. We actually think in some cases maybe the market has seen, you know, a little bit of a bottom. It's tough to call that completely in terms of IRRs, but we've seen, you know, we think in as reflected in a higher deployment in 2018, maybe the market begin to readjust a little bit in a favorable direction. I think it is down to the profile of those particular assets, the money multiple, as we said. There's a reason we're focused on this type of debt. It's not that they're not necessarily higher money multiple opportunities we could look at, but there's a couple of things. First of all, we're looking at 7-year, 84-month ERC, which I think is really important in terms of where we are forecasting. Obviously, the market, you know, generally may be looking at a much longer horizon, which is more reflective of unsecured type debt. So you have a shorter profile here, but a high degree of underlying collateralization, and we believe a very certain, well-underpinned short to medium-term forecast. So where we maybe lack some of the money multiple is the fact that we're not targeting assets that have, in our view, less certain cash flows when you go out to years 7, 10, 15, et cetera. So it is a shorter cash flow, but we also think it's a fundamentally different asset type that reflects a different risk profile.
Okay. So would you characterize the 2018 vintage as still having double-digit unlevered IRRs, or would it be below that?
Yes, I would. I'd also say that, you know, when we quote our IRRs, and I think it's important for you guys when you're talking to everyone, you know, we put all of our costs to collect, we put all of our overheads in there. We don't sort of have a split because we allocate things to an asset. Ours is a double-digit IRR, but it's calculated in a different way to other people who calculate or put different costs into their IRR calculation.
Got you. Understood. Okay, thanks very much.
You know this bottom line IRR.
The next question comes from Helen Rodriguez at CreditSight.
Yeah, hi there. Can I ask a couple of questions? I think for the first one, I think I heard you say that you didn't expect much EBITDA growth in 2019, given the lag between collections and with the revenues and collections, and also the cost of collect comments that you've made about the 18 vintage. Can you give us an idea of the shape of? I know you don't like talking about quarters, but can you give us an idea of the shape of 2019 specifically? To the extent you can, just so that we can have an idea of whether, you know, it's back-end loaded, front-end loaded, if EBITDA will, you know, decline for a couple of quarters, that type of thing. It's kind of difficult to do without knowing the specifics of, you know, how much.
Yeah, I think it's one way you can help do that is if you and clearly there's going to be some volatility on a quarter-by-quarter basis. So, it's also what drops out of the quarter. So if you look at Q1 18 this year, if you remember it, we had a very significant collection in that quarter. So collections in Q1 were very high. We sold a particular bunch of collateral assets in Italy, around 11 million. That's unlikely to be repeated in Q1 this year. So when I'm looking at Q1, performance compared to dropping one very strong quarter and replacing it with an average quarter, you know, I would expect the LTM to drop modestly because we've dropped a very strong quarter. Conversely, by Q3, I'd expect it to be up to a very similar level. So it partly depends on when we deploy, It partly depends on what's falling out. So if you look at what our collections are on a quarterly-by-quarterly basis, you will see some spikes in 18. The profile we're expecting for 19 is a slightly flatter profile. It's still got a bit of a peak in Q4, but it's not as extensive as in the previous years. So it's hard to give you, you know, clearly I've got numbers in front of me.
Yeah, sure.
And there will be, you know, I expect hedging costs might be later than forecast. So it's hard to give a precise guidance. But, it's not going, I'm not expecting any growth in adjusted EBITDA, although I might be pleasantly surprised if collections come in. It just needs a couple of people in the court process to decide to settle out of court, and we can have a very large collection that goes straight to the bottom line in terms of adjusted EBITDA.
Got it. Okay. And then just like big picture, if you're running at roughly 100 million of EBITDA and you're talking about 131 million of deployment plus your interest plus 10 million dividend, one thing and another. Can you just talk about that in the context, just for 19, because obviously subsequently you're expecting this, whatever it is, 35 million kick.
Yeah, no, I'm not expecting EBITDA deployment. I'm not expecting 130 million. That would be more than I've got in our target. You know, our average for the last 2 years is 113. It's going to be said.
Sorry, 113. Yeah.
Yeah, 13. So it could be 100, and it could be 120.
Yeah, but you've still got a bit of a gap, so you're comfortable with the liquidity that you have.
Yeah, I'm comfortable with the liquidity. We end the year with 60 million of liquidity. We're forecast to collect off existing assets 130 million. Our cost base is pretty modest. We will make some purchases during the year. They won't all be in the first half. They'll be towards the back end of the year. And we have additional capacity to put assets into our sort of asset-backed non-recourse finance facility should we need to do so.
Cool. And just can you complete...
Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry. No, just if you can confirm that there's been no, sort of write-offs of any assets, small ones, in the latter half of the year. Just everything's,
I mean, the numbers are as reported in the financial statements, and there was no impairment in the...
Okay. Thank you.
The next question comes from Otto Digital at Stefan Nicholas.
Yes, hello. A few questions, please, if I may. First of all, I would come back to the question about the gross money multiples for your 2018 purchases. I was just wondering, the multiple there is 1.6 you've disclosed, and I'm just wondering, are these assets that are associated with significantly lower collection costs than your average book, or because otherwise, frankly, I can't really quite figure out how you actually make any money on these assets. Because simply put, 25% roughly of your ERCs are expenses, you have finance costs, and then that's pretty much the excess consumed. So just wondering if there's something sort of that is not obvious from the outset, if you like. Another question, maybe related to costs, if I may. Just trying to understand a little better. Is the reason why your cost ratio is lower than it appears, is that basically because of the secured and larger ticket nature of the debts that you purchase? Just trying to get a bit of a color on that, please. And lastly, also on your leverage targets, I'm just wondering, obviously 2 year forward EBITDA, that's like, of course, your most favorable spot with growth in ERCs in 2 years projected. So I'm just wondering, is that something that you would also aim to maintain in year three, year four, year five, according to your forward planning, even if you were maybe not purchasing you know, as much in terms of new portfolios, for example, if the market's very competitive or you just don't find the right things. Thank you.
So look, if I deal with your cost to collect ratio first, clearly you'll have seen from Ed's slide, if you look at the average balance distribution, there's some quite large balance. Someone needs to go on mute. And therefore the cost to collect on those large positions as a percentage of the value collected is very small. It might be 4% for realizing a large collateral position. There might have been marginal legal costs on top. But given the scale of the balance size, then the average cost to collect for those larger balances is significantly less than the average. The 24% that you've quoted is an all-in figure. That includes all of our overheads. That includes you know, management fees, operational structure, SPV costs, and clearly as we grow, those SPV costs get spread across a smaller minority. So, you know, I'm quite comfortable that the 1.6 gross money multiple in terms of a IRR and return and an investment produces a sensible level of profit. And if you look at our financial statements, we are very profitable. In respect of a forward-looking multiple, I try to give that because I try to show you the impact of 2018, where you can see in the first year of full ownership, the percentage of collections is relatively modest, and that almost doubles in year two and year three. That money's been spent. That money is, if you look at our ERC profile, it is out, and there's a significant uplift in adjusted EBITDA. If I look at all of my modelling going forward over a longer period, then I would expect, you know, leverage to peak in 2019, and then actually under pretty much all scenarios, it comes down fairly significantly thereafter.
Thank you.
The last question comes from Benjamin Pasquale at TKO.
Hi, Benjamin.
Hello, guys. Thank you for the call. Just a quick question. Could you provide us with kind of a replenishment rate to keep ERC stable? Is that something that you calculate or that you estimate?
Sorry, I didn't hear you there.
Sorry, could you provide us with kind of a replenishment rate to keep ERC stable? Meaning the annual amount that you have to spend on portfolio just to keep the ERC stable going forward.
It's not something that we generally publish, and we tend not to look at it that way, because I think if you take a one view, because of the pattern of our ERC, where you've got it growing in the future, it's not something that we hugely concentrate on.
Okay, and in terms of purchase plan for next year, are you still expecting to keep a good
next year it'll be approximately 70 million.
Okay, thank you.
There are no further questions at this time. Mr. Ross Roberts, I would like to turn the conference back to you for any additional closing remarks.
Great. Thanks very much, everybody. And hopefully we'll see some of you at the next High Yield Conference. Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.